Okay, Marshall, please call our last case.
Now calling A23-1263, Zaraba Ross, petitioner respondent versus Angel Raylene Smith, appellant.
Okay, welcome to the Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, February 29th, and this is the final case we have on our calendar of four today. I'm Judge Wheelock. I'm sitting with Judge Sleater and Judge Schmidt in courtroom 100. And just a reminder that oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio will be available within about 24 hours on the branch's website. So when you begin, please introduce yourself and introduce the name of your client, ensuring that we will be able to pronounce everyone's names correctly and letting us know about pronouns if that is something you'd like to do. In addition, just a reminder, you will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes. The podium has a timer there in the center. It also adjusts up and down. So with that, I think we're ready when you are, counsel for appellant. There are 15 minutes on the clock.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael D. Ditburner. I represent the appellant Angel Smith. And I will refer to appellant as mother and to respondent as father for purpose of this oral argument. This case involves an appeal of initial custody determination that the parties should share joint legal custody and joint physical custody with equal parenting time. A good question presented by this appeal is it possible for a district court to be deemed to have abused its discretion in initial custody and parenting time determination as long as it makes the findings, all the findings on the best interest factors in 518.17? Especially if a case does not involve maltreatment or domestic abuse. Now, I would submit that the standard of review, abuse of discretion by its very name, contemplates that a district court can abuse its discretion. And we submit that the district court in this case did in fact abuse its discretion by engaging in speculation as to the reasons for the party's conflictual relationship and by speculating how joint custody with equal parenting time could ameliorate that conflict. Second, by making findings that were not only not supported by the evidence, but which were contradicted by father's own testimony. It's important to note in this case that these parents never lived together. They had no history whatsoever of co-parenting their two-year-old child prior to the litigation, and their relationship was fraught with conflict beginning immediately after the child's birth at the hospital. And it also involves a father who had no overnights with the minor child until he was granted not just overnight parenting time, but immediate equal parenting time by the March 16th, 2023 decree. The district court did make findings on the 12 best interest factors and multiple subparagraphs of paragraph 16 and 18 of the findings, with paragraph 16 dealing with the issue of physical or legal custody, paragraph 18 dealing with the issue of physical custody. Permeating throughout these paragraphs of the findings as to the best interest factors, specifically numbers 1, 8, 9, and 12 of 518.17, is demonstrated by the district court's profound belief in the virtues of joint custody and equal parenting time. In other words, that joint custody with equal parenting time is a panacea for reducing conflict between parents who are not getting along, and that parties involved in a high conflict relationship would be able to successfully co-parent if an individual such as father was given the opportunity to do so through joint custody and equal parenting time. I will cite some examples from my brief and in the record.
Can I interrupt you, Mr. Ditburner, before you get to that? Kind of a high-level question about the first issue, and as I look at your brief, and you started to allude to some of the facts I think that you argue are not supported, or findings that are not supported by the record. It strikes me that the bulk of the arguments really hone in on legal custody more so than physical and even parenting time, because it looks like you're pointing out the evidence regarding conflict between the parties, and which kind of leads to the inability to cooperate and make legal decisions. But I didn't see much argument that would really hone in on the physical custody, you know, whether there's or parenting time, that it would be harmful to the child if father has equal, or, you know, those sorts of things we normally see when there's sole physical custody versus joint. Is that a fair overall summary of what your main argument is, the legal custody so much as the other two?
No, I would say that my arguments are with respect to both legal custody and physical custody, especially since we're dealing with a two-year-old child here. and you have the need for the parties to be able to communicate with each other. Just for example, napping schedules, feeding schedules, just the day-to-day type of things where parents really need to communicate. And I will get to that in terms of the record, what Father had to say about those issues, which I think are very significant for purposes of the physical custody argument. I also alluded to in my brief the Minnesota Child-Focused Parenting Time Guide, which does discuss concerns that are related to young children in terms of coming up with a parenting time schedule. So I'm going to talk about some of these findings now, because these are both findings as to legal custody and they're findings as to physical custody. First of all, the judge found that equalizing parental access with the child will remove inequality and reduce conflict. That's paragraph 16H of the findings. Second, excluding one parent from decision-making had only proven to increase conflict between the parents. That's paragraph 16I of the findings. Now getting to the physical custody best interest factors, the court found the lack of an equal parenting time schedule, quote-unquote, fomented division, end of quote, between mother and father. That's the introductory paragraph and paragraph 18 of the findings. Also, joint custody would create the potential for the parties to work collaboratively on a day-to-day basis in pursuit of the child's best interests. That's paragraph 18H of the findings. And in paragraph 18L of the findings, the district court conceded that it was difficult to know what the willingness and ability of the parties was to divide the child's day-to-day care, but that it would direct them to begin demonstrating their willingness to cooperate in the child's day-to-day care and rearing. And then in various parts of the findings, the court strained to find examples of cooperation. For example, setting examples before the child was even born, a Christmas card sent in late 2021 announcing the child's birth, and a sign placed by hospital staff at the hospital room for mother showing the parties being welcomed by the staff. Also, the court cited the fact that there was a lack of disagreement at the hospital regarding a tie-off procedure and the labor and delivery process. And then it cited examples of cooperation coupled during the pendency in paragraph 16A of the findings, mother's exhibits 130 and 146, which were our family wizard messages exchanged between the parties, but these actual exhibits actually show conflict over the rescheduling of parenting time. Then there is father's testimony, which I submit is the real key to comparing his testimony with what the court found. And I am mindful of the fact that this court is an error-correcting court. This court does not reweigh the evidence. It does not challenge the district court's credibility determinations. But I am not asking the court to do that. In fact, if father is to be deemed credible, why not view with credibility his trial testimony, which undermines the district court's findings on parental cooperation and shows that he's an unsuitable candidate? I will cite some examples. At the hospital, he admitted at trial criticizing mother for her lack of reaction as to what he perceived to be mistakes by nurses in bathing the child. He also admitted shortly after mother and the minor child were discharged from the hospital, he had a dispute with mother over whether the child should be bottle-fed or breastfed while at a doctor's office visit, and that he told mother to shut up during that visit. He then admitted, and this is during direct examination, audio recording the doctor's visit that occurred shortly after the discharge because mother tends to make up things, and justified recording his parenting time exchanges with mother because she has lied so much that I have to record myself. He criticized mother for the number of doctor's visits that she took the child to and insinuated that she had a personality disorder or Munchausen syndrome by proxy. He characterized Our Family Wizard, a widely used app used for parental communication, as collecting money when you can just text. He characterized mediation as money taken away from my child that can go toward college and things like that. He asked that the district court select a different daycare than the one mother had the child attending because of his conflicts with the daycare. He admitted during cross that the mother of his now adult daughter was awarded sole legal and physical custody of their child, and that the district court in that case had found that he and his daughter's mother had an inability to cooperate and communicate, and a number of mishaps had occurred as a result of that inability to communicate. He also admitted that the mother of his now adult daughter obtained two writs of habeas corpus due to his illegal detention of the child. He admitted during cross that he told mother on both November 27, 2021 and January 9, 2022 on posts over Our Family Wizard that he was going to keep the child overnight, even though he did not have court-ordered parenting time at the point in time. He admitted during cross that Judge Burns, the predecessor judge to the district court judge that did the trial, had to order him to communicate with mother regarding the minor child's feeding and napping schedules. Also on cross, he testified that he disagreed with the way mother was communicating with him about the minor child's feeding and napping over our family wizard, and claimed that her communications with him were irrelevant or ineffective. So, to sum up here, joint custody and equal parenting time can be seen by some folks as something that's fair and gives both parents equality. But in this case, the district court believed that to the extent that mother and father were not getting along, that that would change if father just had the opportunity to demonstrate by having equal parenting time and joint custody.
But counsel, isn't there specifically findings by the court that the parties have, I mean, I'm just reading from here, the parties have successfully made major decisions on behalf of the daughter and her well-being. Dad testified credibly about his desire to work with mom in making decisions on behalf of their daughter. His testimony is credible because, and so the court made specific findings that there was a desire to work together.
The court made findings regarding that, but then there's all this testimony that the father gave, which completely undercuts that.
But the court heard all that, yet still found father credible. And that was all in front of the court, heard all this testimony, still found father credible, and still made the determination that there's a indication that they want to work together. And that's not something that, you know, we don't get to touch that credibility determination.
Well, I mean, to me, that's a sort of a conclusory statement. I'm willing to cooperate, you know, but I don't believe in cooperating here, there, and everywhere else. And so that, to me, the specific examples of lack of cooperation that he testified to, his disinclination to use our family wizard, his belief that he shouldn't have to mediate, that undercuts the conclusory statement that he's making and undercuts the court's findings. And the fact is that the court made findings that the only reason that there had been conflict was because he hadn't been placated. He hadn't gotten his equal parenting time. And that if equal parenting time occurs and joint custody occurs, then everything is going to be fine and rosy. And that sounds to me like a very strong philosophical belief on the part of the district court. But that's speculation.
I'm not sure I read the district court's order that way. I guess I don't see the language that you're... Can you point us to specific language that shows that the district court said, I'm imposing my beliefs here?
Well, I'm just going by saying that, you know, what the district court has found here, equalizing parental access will remove inequality and reduce conflict. That's paragraph 16H of the findings. To me, that sounds like a strongly stated philosophical belief. That's paragraph 16H. And that excluding one parent from decision-making has proven to increase conflict between the parents. That's paragraph 16I. There is nothing in the record to support those findings, and those findings demonstrate speculation, in my opinion.
But there's other, going through, there are 14 credibility determinations that the district court made to find father credible. Most of those were finding father credible. It seems that you're asking us to find that credibility determination clearly erroneous based on other testimony that the district court also heard.
Well, but it's the father's testimony, the person that's being cited as credible, and he's testifying about all his conflicts with the mother, and he's testifying about disinclination to mediate, a disinclination to communicate. He's admitting that he was required to communicate by court order. And to me, that really does undercut a general conclusory finding that he's willing to cooperate, or a statement by him is these are specifics as opposed to a general stated desire to cooperate. So,
well, the district court did get specific in some of the credibility determinations. If you look at 16G, the district court said the father's testimony is credible because he's testifying about being excited to get more involved in the child's life and have more time, and how he has helped mother in the past. And those are very specific.
Yeah, I'm sure that I'm sure that is credible, that he's very excited to be more involved in the child's life.
And that he helped mother in the past.
But how? How did he help her?
Dad's behaviors in helping mom during her high-risk pregnancy and immediately following the birth of their daughter manifests the values of a man who sincerely wants to help, care for, and safeguard the people in his life. That, I mean, that is pretty specific of what and how.
So that's before the child's even born. And so you can find many cases where before a child's birth, you have a happy couple that are getting along. And then you compare that with what happened at the hospital. Right away, he's disagreeing with her because he doesn't like her reaction to what the nurses were doing. And then he is getting into conflicts with her at the doctor's visit immediately after the discharge from the hospital. So what I'm saying is that you can't use examples before a child's birth when everything that happened after the child's birth demonstrates a high conflict situation where people are unable to cooperate and communicate. And that's what the WPATA case drives at, which says that joint custody is inappropriate where the parties lack the ability to cooperate and communicate. And Chapman v. Chapman, joint custody should not be used to coerce cooperation from parents who have been unable to cooperate or amicably settle disputes about their children. Now, I understand that the respondent has said, well, those cases are no longer good law. You know, and what I would say in response to that is, number one, there was a presumption in favor of joint legal custody that was enacted by the courts, by the state legislature in 1986. And at the time WPATA was decided, that was already in place. And then you had the issue of the fact that both WPATA and Chapman have been cited since then, since 2005, when this court in Challenger versus Challenger said that there's not a presumption against joint physical custody.
Mr. Dippiner, can I ask you a question? I
know yes. No, that's fine.
I want to come back to your answer to Judge Wheelock. And interestingly, because this goes, I think, to what you're just finishing up with, too, and your characterization of that particular phrase, the judge equalizing these parents' access to the daughter will remove the inequality and reduce conflict. Now, interesting, that kind of goes to my first question. That's in the the factors related to legal custody. But prior to that, and this is why I have a little different read of this, putting it together, a couple sentences ahead of that, in 2 years, dad has not had a single overnight with his daughter. Without a doubt, the significant imbalance has had a negative and spiraling effect on the parents' relationship, which is not in the child's, the daughter's best interest. Now, I read that as the judge was observing that you had this huge imbalance of any parental involvement, and that that part of the concern was until you have a equal legal balance, then that would necessarily then give each side an equal point. So the point being is that it was that imbalance itself that was creating the tension. That's how I read that. Why am I wrong in looking at that together in that way?
Well, I mean, that sounds like a philosophical belief to me, that that conflict is caused by imbalance. And
my question, though, is that I'm reading those facts found by the court. So my point is I'm not reading that as a philosophical imbalance, but the court was making findings as to the situation between the two of them, which the court found causes what conflict was existing.
Well,
Is that why is that inaccurate in terms of the record that was presented to the court at trial?
Well, I mean, I'll point out paragraph 18, which deals with physical custody and the issue of joint physical custody. The lack of an equal parenting time schedule fomented division. You know, to me, that's speculation.
But it ties into that. In other words, the judge in multiple places really did focus in on that, and I assume that's based on the evidence that was presented during the trial.
And the court also said, I don't know what the willingness of ability is to divide the child's day-to-day care, but it would direct them to do so and begin demonstrating their willingness to do so. And again, I get back to the issue. This is a two-year-old child. This is a situation where you're going from 0 to 70. You're creating a situation where somebody that hasn't had overnights all of a sudden now has equal parenting time, you know, full stop. And when you're dealing with a child that age, it's not like a teenager where parents can do parallel parenting. You have a very young child. You have to communicate with each other if you're going to be sharing parenting time on an equal basis, because the child's day-to-day care and what the child is eating, how the child is napping, what the child's health needs are, you have to communicate with that to make joint physical custody with equal parenting time successful. And so that's why I think that there's findings regarding the issue of cooperation and both the court's findings as to legal custody and also as to physical custody. So I reject the notion in the case of a two-year-old child that you don't have to cooperate with each other. I think that if you want to have a two-year-old child in equal parenting time, you have to have people that demonstrate the willingness and ability to cooperate. And he already showed by his relationship with the mother of his now adult daughter a distinct lack of cooperation and communication. And so communication is key. If you don't want to communicate and if you have a history of not communicating, how can you be a successful co-parent in a joint physical custody with equal parenting time arrangement is what I'm saying.
Thank you.
And this is an unusual case.
So you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll turn to counsel for respondent. Again, remember to introduce yourself, your client, and to feel free to adjust the podium if needed. You can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Richard Crabb, and I represent the respondent, Zorba Ross. Minnesota case law is replete with precedential holdings that the district court is imbued with broad discretion regarding custody and parenting time issues. And that discretion is not to be disturbed absent clear error, where the appellate court is left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. The Vagnus case, it's cited 607 Northwest 2nd 468, has been repeatedly cited for its clear explanation regarding the very high burden an appellant has on such a case. First, the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to the district court's findings. Second, the appellate court must grant significant deference to the district court's credibility determinations, and the appellate court is precluded from resolving conflicts in the evidence. Third, even if the record might support findings other than those made by the district court, that does not, in and of itself, show that the district court's findings are defective. And fourth, after reviewing the findings under these requirements, the appellate court may only reverse or remand the district court based on that definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been made. The appellant has failed to meet her burden in this case. The Vagnus case has concluded that the current law leaves scant, if any, room for an appellate court to question the district court's balancing of the best interest considerations. Additionally, Minnesota law, including the cases of Picula and Ollie, which was cited by the district court, have established that the district court is not required to appoint a custody evaluator, and that even if the court does appoint one, the district court is not bound to the recommendations of the custody evaluator, but rather the district court is the ultimate trier of fact and decision maker. And so long as the district court provides detailed findings which support its analysis of the best interest factors and demonstrates that it was able to reach its decision without a custody evaluation, then no custody evaluation is necessary. And the district court did just this in this case. The district court specifically addressed this issue as part of its lengthy and detailed 23-page order, including a thorough analysis of the 12 best interest factors over the course of 9 pages of its 23-page order. The district court's findings are supported by the record, including the testimony and evidence presented by the respondent. The district court specifically addressed the issue of a lack of a custody evaluator on pages 2 through 4. The district court articulated specifically its rationale for determining the custody evaluation was not necessary. The district court was able to conduct its own thorough analysis of the best interest factors, and the district court carefully considered all of the evidence presented, weighing the credibility of both the parties as well as their witnesses, and the ultimate decision to award the parties joint custody pursuant to an equal parenting time schedule is supported by the record, and therefore it is not an abuse of discretion. Now, the appellant does cite cases from 1984 in 1993.
Mr. Crabb, before you get into that,
certainly.
Mr. Dippener summarize some of the particular findings that, on their face, of course, if they were alone, mm-hmm. certainly would not support a finding that the parties could be able to cooperate in making mm-hmm. joint legal decisions. He included some reference to your client's testimony. What findings would you direct us to that you believe counterbalance that supports the old court's ultimate finding, especially as to joint legal custody, the ability to cooperate?
Certainly, Your Honor. I would point the court to what has already been raised, right, that the district court made specific findings that the parties had cooperated previously, prior to the child's birth, and my client had brought the appellant to every single one of her appointments at Mayo early in the morning, taken time off, done everything in his power for her, and then immediately after the child's birth, when she needed to have that tie-off procedure, they both quickly agreed, they cooperated, they communicated, and they made that decision jointly. So that demonstrates a history of cooperation. Now, the fact
Counsel,
that...
Counsel, doesn't the change in behaviors and cooperation between the parents matter, though? Shouldn't the district court have looked at how the relationship deteriorated and have taken that into consideration?
Certainly, Your Honor, but it's a two-way street, right? Cooperation goes both ways. And so the appellant can't argue that she should be awarded custody because my client refused to cooperate with her, because she was also part of the struggle here. She was part of the problem. And indeed, the court could have easily, based on these same findings, made a determination that my client should be awarded sole custody based on the lack of cooperation from the appellant herself. Court didn't do that. And that court didn't make that determination because the court decided, based on my client's testimony, that my client was willing to work with the appellant. And opposing counsel does cite to the record about my client not wanting to utilize our family wizard or mediation, but that doesn't prove that he was unwilling to cooperate. What that proves, in fact, is quite the opposite, that he believes that they don't need those additional sources of assistance, that they are able to just text directly with each other and talk through and work through any of these issues without the need to pay for OFW or to pay for mediation. My client is so confident that in the party's ability to cooperate and communicate that he doesn't think that those are necessary means of settlement resolution. Did that adequately address your question, Your Honor?
It did. Maybe I'll just bring it back to the infamous finding that the court made, that the appellant's pointing out. Equalizing these parents' access to their daughter will remove this inequality, and I think it's the second half of that that the appellant's really focusing on, and reduce conflict. Mm-hmm. Their point being that simply granting joint legal can't in and of itself reduce conflict. How do you understand the court came to that sentence as part of her findings and the ultimate decision?
Certainly. And the court did analyze all 12 best interest factors with regard to both legal custody and physical custody. And so I would refer the court to her findings on the legal custody. But ultimately, I think it's telling that she made the decision that the party should alternate being present at the medical appointments as a way to ensure that both parties are involved in their daughter's life and that they have to communicate, right? Because if only one of them is there, they have to cooperate and communicate with each other. So that's how she ensured that there would be cooperation and that there would be communication between the parties. And so I think that was actually a good decision by the district court in her order. And that's how I think the court can look to the district court making that determination that does reduce conflict by forcing these parties to have a more balanced approach to their daughter and then forcing them to communicate more then.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, the appellant does cite cases from 1984 and 1993, along with unpublished opinions from 2013 and 2016, in support of her position. However, those cases are in a posit because they analyzed the previously enacted statute at a time when joint custody was not the preferred arrangement. This is simply not the current status of the custody statute, which was amended and went into effect on August 1st, 2015. And indeed, the current custody statute specifically designates that there is no presumption against or for joint custody. And the cases cited by the appellants all have different facts from the case at bar. One of them involves domestic abuse. Another of them involves a close call where there's numerous factors cited on both sides by the district court. Many of them all analyze the previous statute because the case, even though it was from 2016 or 17 in the appellate court, it started before August 15th, August 1st of 2015, and so is still applying to the previous statute. But nonetheless, in the case at bar, the judge determined that all 12 best interest factors supported an award of joint custody and equal parenting time. This was not a close call, Your Honor. This was a clear decision that is supported by the record. There were some findings that were neutral. I take that back. But every other finding that was not deemed neutral supported an award of joint custody. This was not a close call by the court. And the appellant was unable to cite a single published opinion where the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded a district court's custody and parenting time decision based on the current custody statute. There's a reason for that. And it's because the district court is given such broad discretion on these issues that there's basically no basis for reversals or remands, especially in a case like this where the district court has provided such significant and detailed findings which are supported by the record and which led the court to the ultimate conclusion regarding joint custody and equal parenting time. The other thing to consider, Your Honors, is that the appellant focuses only and primarily on one of the 12 best interest factors, which is the willingness and ability of the parties to cooperate in the day-to-day care and rearing of their child.
Counsel, as I look at the 12 factors, I think that some of the arguments that appellant is making go to a few more of the factors than just that one. There's factor for purposes of corresponding with the district court order. There's factor G, you know, the willingness and ability of the parent to participate in the decisions. Effect on child's well-being and development to any changes that are made in the decision-making. We look at the willingness and ability of parents to cooperate in the decisions. So I'm seeing maybe three or four that their arguments are relevant to. If we were to agree with appellant that there was clear error on those three or four, is that enough for us to reverse, or are we still required to affirm?
I believe that you're still required to affirm, Your Honor, and the reason is that while some of these other factors may tie into it, their main argument is the lack of cooperation, the lack of the party's ability to cooperate and how that impacts the child. And there's simply that one factor, so even if that one factor weighs against the finding of joint custody and equal parenting time, the fact that the court made all these other findings that weighs in favor of joint custody and equal parenting time demonstrates that the district court's determination is adequately supported by the evidence and not contrary to the law. And appellant's entire premise of her argument is belied by the fact that the parties have demonstrated an ability to cooperate over the past year since the entry of this order. Indeed, neither party has been back before the district court regarding any issues of non-cooperation. And the district court specifically credited the fact that my client has already raised his adult daughter, he helped raise his adult niece now, he's a school principal who acts in loco parentis for literally hundreds of children in his school. So clearly, if my client is able to be entrusted with hundreds of other children, the district court is warranted in determining that my client should be awarded joint custody and equal parenting time for his own daughter. With regard to the issue of the district court's order that the parties alternate bringing the child to the medical appointments, the district court did spend six pages analyzing in detail the best interest factors as they apply to the issue of legal custody. And as I referenced before, that the district court, in making this determination, I think that made a smart decision here because it essentially forces the parties to communicate and cooperate. And the district court did not abuse its discretion. It properly applied the law regarding the child's best interest in ordering the parties to alternate bringing attending the child's medical appointments.
Counsel, I'll ask you about the vacation time for July. It's an issue appellant raised. And is that vacation time just reserved for July? Or is it seems to me that if mother wants to take the child on a vacation for more than a week in February, that is not going to comply with the court's order anymore. So why is it just July that they can go on a vacation for more than a couple of days?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think what the court was trying to address was the fact that both parties have family that live out of the state of Minnesota. And so having a two-week vacation rather than a one-week vacation will allow more time for them to travel outside of the state and then to also spend good, significant time with paternal and maternal relatives. And the court chose July because the court assumed that that would interfere the least with the child's schedule, especially once the child starts attending preschool and school. Also, my client is a principal, and so he has the summers more or less off. I mean, he's still working throughout the summer, but he has more availability to leave during the summers than he does during the winter. And the court also allowed the parties to modify this, and they can always cooperate if they agree, right? They can always have flexibility here. And so if mother wants to bring the child down to Florida in February, let's say there's a wedding or some family reunion or something, she can always communicate with my clients and make that request, and my client would consider it.
But your client could say no based on this, what the court's schedule is for parenting time. If mother wants to go on a spring break vacation or just a vacation generally, the child's not in school yet, and so wants to go in March to go visit some folks, your client, at least from what you're saying, your client could say no, and based on the court's parenting schedule, she has no remedy for that.
And the court's order does say unless otherwise agreed by the parties in writing, right? So you're correct. My client would have to agree with that, but the court also allows that flexibility. And so if the mother wasn't able to receive her request for the vacation parent time, she's free to file a motion with the court at that point if it's so important that she exercise this in February. But I don't think that's a basis to reverse or remand the district court. I mean, I think the court supported adequately its determination for why the vacation parenting time should happen in July, and that if there's any disputes in the future about that, they can go to mediation to try to work it out, and then they can go back to district court to address it. But otherwise, the court set that, so.
We're over time, but I do have a question. Why isn't it an abuse of discretion for the court to not have addressed the holidays of Martin Luther King Day and Juneteenth when those are clearly important to these family members and to this child?
Certainly, Your Honor. And I believe with respect to the holiday schedule, again, the district court's order provided the parties with the ability to be flexible and to modify the holiday schedule. And the district court also appropriately recognized that many of these holidays would be rotated between the parties simply by virtue of the rotating 2-2-3 parenting time schedule that they're
already operating. That could be an assumption for a Christmas holiday, though, as well.
What's that?
That we could make that assumption for a Christmas holiday as well, but typically we don't. I mean, typically the district courts address those major holidays more specifically.
And I guess I would address that. You know, the Juneteenth, the Martin Luther King holidays, the parties can agree otherwise. And if their parent time is going to alternate between Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday every week, it's probably going to end up where they're going to ultimately probably alternate those holidays anyways. And so I don't think that's a basis to reverse or remand the district court simply by failing to include those holidays in the schedule. Parties, again, can also reach an amended agreement and just include those on their own. If they so choose. So.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay, and now we turn to appellant's counsel for the last word. We'll have 5 minutes on the clock. Feel free to adjust the podium. Remember to introduce yourself again for our audio recording, and you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, this is Michael D. Ditburner appearing on behalf of the appellant, Angel Smith. So counsel raised during his argument the court's order requiring the parties to alternate taking the child to doctor's visits. Father testified that he believes that mother has Munchausen syndrome by proxy, that she is imbalanced in the way that she approaches the child's medical care. So mother brings the child to a physician for an appointment because of some concern regarding the child. And as often happens, there's a follow-up visit that has to be scheduled. Then father believes that, you know, this wasn't necessary, I'm not gonna do it. And so you can see the problem with that particular part of the court's order. With regard to the issue of vacation time that was raised by Judge Schmidt, you know, my client is not an educator. She's works for the city of Brooklyn Park and as an assistant city manager. The respondent father, he has the ability to take that time off in July because he works in education. And so this is something that is extremely problematic for my client. And to say that things can be figured out by way of mediation when somebody doesn't want to mediate, according to their trial testimony, when there's been this type of history of conflict, that's cold comfort that these holidays will be suddenly agreed to by father. And so that's quite problematic in and of itself.
Mr. Ditburner, can I ask, you know, answer to all these questions that we've had to both counsel, don't they really go to what happens next? In other words, both parties are adults, very well educated, and they have a 2-year-old child, and either they're going to follow through with their statements. The father said, I will attempt, and of course she's going to have to do the same. These are pretty simple issues. I'll do February, and he either says yes or he says no, you do a swap. So then we find out, you know, whether it's 3 years or 5 years, but it seems like on its face, we do start with a presumption, in fact, it's a presumption on joint legal anyway, that, good grief, alternating medical, but I can't go to the next two, why don't you go? And then I go to the next three. Isn't that less an issue of an error in the order than let's see if these two parents can be parents and adults about it, and if they can't, someone comes back with a motion that we got to switch because it's being hopeless.
You know, I'd rather take care of that at the front end,
but my,
at the back end, and
right,
incur
my question,
all those
though,
fees.
It really goes to the your point. It's only a 2-year-old child, and we've got the testimony the court found credible. That, and so let's see if the parties follow through with this credibility finding, and they do or they don't.
Let's get to that issue of credibility where somebody says, yes, I am willing to cooperate. Somebody can truly believe that they are willing to cooperate. But by their actions, their repeated actions, and their own trial testimony, that they lack that ability. And that's what the court should take into consideration here. You know, it is true that most initial custody determinations should be affirmed. You know, I would say probably in excess of 90%. But I submit that this case is the exception that proves the rule. And we honor the abuse of discretion standard by showing those particular cases in which an award of joint physical custody and joint legal custody and equal parenting time was inappropriate, involving this 2-year-old child, where the parties never lived together, never had a history of co-parenting, and had nothing but conflict since the child's birth. And so I ask the court to reverse the district court and change its decision with regard to physical custody and legal custody and parenting time. Thank you, unless you have any further questions for me.
Seeing no questions, that concludes today's calendar. So just want to let you know that we really appreciate your argument here today. We appreciate the briefing that was submitted. It will help us. We will consider the case submitted at this point, and a decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. Thank you. We are in recess. We are adjourned.
All rise.